Hey guys, just a couple of words before we start the show. Just wanted to remind you that this is a listener-supported podcast, and that means your support is crucial in keeping the show going. Is there any reason that you haven't made a donation to the show? I'd like to make it as easy for you as possible, and the easiest I can make it for now is by your going to the website, theconversationpod.com/support, and clicking on the donate button. If you could go to theconversationpod.com/support and make a donation of any kind, as much as you can afford, comfortably, it would be very much appreciated. So thank you very much in advance, and now let's get on to the show. This is The Conversation. It's episode 114 with Roger White, painter, co-editor and creator of the art journal Paper Monument, and earlier this year, published author of the book The Contemporaries, Travels in the 21st Century Art World, which is a book that I cannot recommend highly enough. I put in about, let's say, 30 little green post-it thingies as bookmarks for things to talk about. We probably got to about five of them, but there was just so much that, you know, and his being an artist and somebody who has sort of investigated or sort of dug into the undercurrents, the mechanisms of the art world, the art industry, I think is the term he uses, and I guess I prefer that one in a way too, just gave us so much to talk about and avenues for so many questions and an interesting sort of ponderings. And it led to the longest episode yet by far of this podcast, and I think richly and deservedly so. I hope you agree. I don't want to oversell it. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com, where you can go become a fan of the show on social media. You can write to us. You can participate in the Don't Call Us segment and so on. You can donate, of course. Before I get back to Roger, I wanted to let you know, if you haven't already heard it or been aware, the last episode of the show is the first live podcast of The Conversation, which took place in Los Angeles on a very hot day early in September. Let us know what you think of it. I wanted to make a quick correction. One of my panelists, I mispronounced her name. It's actually Katie Bodie. Katie Bodie, just so you know. It's a name you're going to continue to hear. And back to The Contemporaries. I first found out about it through the radio, appropriately enough. Roger White was a guest on a show that I listen to often via podcast called The Leonard Lopate Show out of WNYC. And there's an interesting story about that in our conversation. But that was the tip-off to me. Otherwise, I'm not sure, honestly, because I don't generally peruse the book reviews for art books, looking for art books to read. But it turned out I can't recommend this book highly enough. And he is, as it turns out, a great writer as an artist. And, you know, and we, in fact, talk about the identity factor. Like, if you become known as X and you also do Y, what does that mean? What does that look like? Before we get there, just wanted to let you know that Artillery Magazine's fall issue, it's called the Back to School issue, is out on newsstands and in galleries now. Go check it out. Among other articles, they do a piece on MFA grad schools. Which ones are worth going to? Or are they even worth going to at all? Check it out at Artillery Magazine in most galleries and online. Quick clarification before we start. At one point when we were talking about assistants, he has in a chapter on art assistants, which, you know, is obviously a fascinating topic to many of us artists, as well as writers and perhaps gallerists. We talk about a guy named Sean Greathead, and I neglected to mention when I mentioned his name that he is, in fact, an assistant for Jeff Koons. That becomes clear a little later, but want to give you a heads up about that now. So without further ado, thank you very much for being here, and I look forward to talking to you on the back end. So you're in Vermont?
I am, yeah. My wife teaches at Middlebury College. So we're based up here, and I sort of commute to art centers to do my thing. But I have a studio up here and
right.
And the whole deal now. So.
When you say art centers, do you mean various places where you have teaching gigs?
Yeah, and going down to New York to show my face now and then. But mainly, yeah, I teach at RISD in the Springs and sort of here and there in the New England to New York corridor, as do many people that I know. So, but I learned that Vermont is actually, it just was not designed to for you to get anywhere or come here if you're not there. So, enormously insular and no public transportation.
Interesting. Well, when you just said a moment ago that a lot of people you know are you know doing something to this effect, do you mean then that a lot of artists that you know are living out of the city and commuting in for various occasions?
It seems more and more. I don't know if it's my generational thing where I'm getting to the age where people are thinking of that, or they're the reverse. They're living in the city, but they're teaching in these far-flung schools, and the result is that they're basically on the road constantly. But I have sort of felt that there does seem to be a bit more exodus from New York lately, although perhaps that, again, that's a generational or a time of life thing.
As in, I've spent enough time in New York or something along those lines?
Yeah, or as in, like, I'm almost 40 and my peer group is, you know, maturing past the point of wanting to live out in Bushwick for, you know, and considering that and then trying to think about or having kids or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Assessing the artistic lifestyle in, and increasingly sort of a city which is increasingly hostile, one would say,
yeah,
to that life.
Absolutely. And it's kind of an ongoing theme with people that I talk to who are based or pseudo based in New York. And even, you know, now in Los Angeles, you know, it seems to be scarily becoming more of a conversation as well. But I did want to ask you before I forget, but you still have some sort of real estate footprint in Brooklyn?
No, I have I'm renting again. I'm subletting again. I'm subletting a studio just to sort of be able to show my paintings to people who don't, for some reason or another, want to come to Vermont for a studio.
right.
So
when you're
sort of essential.
So when you're showing your face in New York, as you put it, you're also hopefully showing the faces of your work to, you know, people you can get by.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I sort of thought about in the book was this, you know, the idea that we've had for a very long time since conceptual art, that it's, you know, the information revolution has made it such that art can be transmitted through the electronic media, now the digital media, and doing everything face to face is anachronistic. And we've seen different versions of that idea. You know, and there was the telecommuting art worker of the 60s through the sort of relational aesthetics jet setter of the 90s. And yet art is so sort of hostile to the being fully sort of digitized and a product of the network, it's still such a face-to-face business. And that's I've certainly sort of learned that firsthand from leaving the city and having anxiety about it. And it does seem to be played out in the economic agony that artists have about, you know, you really do have to sort of, you know, be in a place with other artists and see them. And you can't just do everything online.
No. Absolutely.
As much as I'd like.
But meanwhile, and since we're on the topic, and I don't want to spend too much time on it because we have your book to get to, but the Instagram phenomenon, you know, seems to be, and this is more of a generational thing too, but I'm not necessarily, mm-hmm. but it seems to be a really good starting point for people. So maybe that becomes the starting point, and then the face-to-face thing follows later.
Yeah, I resisted for so long, or I just didn't think I'd be interested. I love it. It's so, I'm completely in the Instagram tank just because I get to see what artists are working on, you know, and I love the sort of casual studio shots that people will post. And I really, as a painter, I really enjoy that. And there's something very up close about how artists sometimes photograph their own work in a casual setting that gets lost in, you know, more and more formalized representations of art online. And it's tremendously satisfying. I don't know, like, is it going to change the art market dramatically? Is it really, or is that sort of a shared delusion or wishful thinking? I mean, do the institutions participate in the flow of art over Instagram, do you think?
The big institutions, it's just, I've just been hearing a little bit that it's, you know, certain galleries, I think, are relying on it quite heavily, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know, but the funny thing about it is I sort of found the people that I knew before on Instagram, and I'm happy that I can sort of, you know, see what they're up to on a daily basis, but I haven't made a lot of discoveries, in fact, on that platform.
Right.
I don't know if that's true for, that's certainly a generational thing. But.
Right, right. Well, since we're talking about you and being in Vermont, and by the way, it would be remiss if I didn't ask, are there any other of your cohort kind of in the area? I know you said it's hard getting people to come there, but are there any people who have made Vermont for one reason or another their post New York home along with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of teachers up here, you know, and the more a lot of them are hiding, I think. There's a lot of people that moved up here to, you know, put New York in the rearview mirror, but I definitely see people that are, they tend to be attached to the schools, like Pamela Fraser is a great painter, teacher at the University of Vermont up in Burlington. Trini Dalton is a writer, very active in the art world, who's heading up a art and publishing MFA in Montpelier, you know, so there's definitely people around, and it's, but you know, there's very few people. And so I think it's the 49th most populous state, the second least populous state,
right?
I think, which is hard to believe. So, you know, chances are pretty good that there's not a whole ton of them are going to be jazzed about contemporary art.
Well, I guess the one advantage, the most prominent advantage that comes to mind is you don't feel like you have to get out of town.
Right, exactly.
In the escapist
sense. I live in vacation land.
Yeah.
Which is a very, very weird phenomenon.
So you can be looking forward to Fall Colors, what, in about a month's time? Something like that? Or less?
Yeah, it's already happening. It's already, I tell you, it's...
Wow.
They're turning as we speak.
So you wrote this book, The Contemporaries, Being an Artist. And I think one of the obvious questions is, to what extent did you put your work on hold to do it, or did you somehow combine the two?
Yeah, to a greater extent than I had initially imagined, to a far greater extent than I wished. I also, my wife and I also had a baby right in the thick of writing the book. So, I sort of wasn't a painter for a couple of years. I was painting, but they were not very good. They did not go anywhere, and it was not to the extent where I could really make any forward progress in the studio. It was rough. I was sad. I discovered in writing the book how much happier I am in the studio than in front of the laptop. Not that it hasn't been a fantastic experience, and I'm totally glad I did it and want to write more. But I reconfirmed being a painter in the process of that.
I can see how being in front of the laptop for extended periods, especially, you know, trying to craft the copy that you did, that going back into the studio after doing that would it would probably seem a lot more free and enjoyable. Because being in the studio, I hope you have experienced, can be very trying at times as well.
Yeah. I guess it's the form of self torture that I'm happiest with.
The painting form
and the writing form is a whole other kettle of fish or whatever. And I would sort of, I could only get through it by sort of telling myself I'm not really a writer. So I'm just going to bluff my way through this experience and get back to being, you know, properly tormented as a visual artist.
Right. And then I'm imagining that when the book was completed and was published and came out into the stores, that you had to go on a little bit of a tour with it, and that also took you away from the studio. How true would you say that is?
What I learned is, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't want to go on a tour. I did some things. I think publishers are a lot less likely to do that unless they're for a first book. They were kind of like, okay, go to Brooklyn and of course, and do the radio and this and that and here and there, but they weren't sending me to Pittsburgh or anything, for which I was very grateful. But yeah, it was a lot of it was mainly a lot of sort of worrying about what people were going to think of the book and having anxiety about going on New York Public Radio and saying something totally idiotic on live radio. That took a the stress of that took more time than actual sort of traveling around and doing promotional things.
Okay, well, you set me up completely because this was going to be one of my questions anyway, which is the Leonard Lopate Show, which I've been a longtime listener of in podcast form, and that's where I was first introduced to you. You know, so
show,
you know, obviously broke you to a larger public, I would think. I don't know if this is in any way offensive to say, but I would imagine a lot of casual art observers probably were introduced to you through that as opposed to, you know, the hardcore art people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's public radio in New York is incredibly well listened and discussed. I learned you should never look at the comments on sort of the website of the Leonard Lopate Show if you've just been on them, especially if you're talking about art. That's sort of the interesting, one of the things about doing the book has been checking in with the antagonism towards contemporary art that a sort of a general audience sometimes still feels, I got a very positive review of the book, which was essentially like, contemporary art isn't just bullshit. That was the guy's opening line, and sort of this made him think that it wasn't just totally nonsensical what we all do. So it was interesting to sort of check in with that, because I'm sure you know, sort of, if you're just blissfully around artists and art people, you know, there's a real self-reinforcing reality system at play where it's perfectly natural and normal, and then you sort of cross the street and go into another conversation and people think you're crazy.
Right. So were you nervous at all going on that show?
Well, the thing about that was I was very nervous. I've done radio a little bit with my co-editor for Paper Monument, which is an art journal that I produce along with Dusko Petrovic, another artist, and we've gone in and done things together, and so I knew the drill a little bit. I knew that I had a very specific time I was going to start at whatever, like 1:33 p.m. So at 1:25, I did my, I'm going to go to the bathroom and make sure I'm not, you know, having a bladder emergency. And then there was a knock on the bathroom door as soon as I got in. I said, like, Leonard wants you on right now. And so I zipped up and ran across the studio, like literally ran, got into the chair, put the headphones on. He pointed at me saying, say we're live. And he said, So why should people care about contemporary art? His opening line, and I'm still kind of panting, and it was a lot. I'm very happy I did it, but I was.
That's horrifying.
Could wait a while. It was pretty horrible. It was pretty horrible.
But meanwhile, you, from what I remember of it, you sounded very relaxed.
That's great. That's great to hear. I was in a stress blackout.
Right.
It was a good conversation. He was very challenging.
Yeah.
In certain ways, and I didn't know about him that he came from a visual arts background and had been a painter and studied with Reinhardt and that was very much part of his thing. So I think there was a kind of a desire to assert a different generational standpoint or something.
Sure.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I think he's generally pretty sympathetic to artist guests. And by the way, by the way, I have to say, I was thinking about this, I think, earlier today, that you actually managed a way to get onto the show, as an artist, as a writer, technically. But it's probably the easiest way for you to have gotten on, because I was thinking, how many painters has he had on the show? And the only one I could think of is Bryce Martin, maybe.
I know. So, I was second on the list.
Yeah.
It's funny, and painters aren't used to doing that in the way that I think writers are. It's part of their thing to talk. And
yeah,
I did radio in with the station in Marfa, Texas, because obviously a huge, small place, but major contemporary art situation, and the guy who did the shows was interviewing all the artists that came to town, and just said it was so strange. They felt it was so funny to be on the radio, because nobody ever wants to hear what the artists have to say in that context.
Right. Well, what kind of listenership do you think they have down there?
I don't know. I don't know. I guess it's it's Texas is big and there's people out there, but I don't know how many of them are checking in, but I assume it's the town is so plugged into art because of the Chinati Foundation and other things.
Something that, we talked earlier on about how you're a painter, and if I remember right, I don't think that's something that you cop to directly in the course of the writing of the book. Am I right?
Yeah. I call myself I mentioned that I've painted and I do paint, but I made a decision not to dwell on that or sort of incorporate that directly, mainly because I was much more interested in getting out and talking to people. I was interested in other people's experience of art, not necessarily my own, and sort of trying to make that, I don't want to say visible, but that's not right. Obviously, make that legible in the book. So, and I just couldn't figure out a very suave way to go between a sort of some cheesy my story in art and segue into it being about other things. So I sort of ended up leaving it out.
Yeah,
No, I'm done.
Okay. I'm just realizing that the reason that I brought it up is because I think it flavors the book with a different context, and I think we're going to be, while we're selling some books here, we're biasing people a little bit, because having read that Dana Schutz chapter, for example, knowing about what you've said, and maybe we can reorder the edit of this conversation. Mm-hmm. But knowing that you're a painter and the things that you say about painting, it just colors them a certain way. I mean, it's a very ecumenical approach that you take to painting, to the art world, to the art industry, and knowing maybe more in detail about where you're coming from would bias one's experience a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want it to be, I didn't want to be sneaky about it, but
right.
But it definitely, I think the sort of the experience of, I mean, you know, I've written about art for a long time before, and I felt like I was channeling that critical, you know, wearing that hat more so than the sort of artist hat as I went into sort of doing it in a longer format for the book. But the book was really came out of just things that I was curious about and that people that I knew or wanted to know or stories that I've heard, you know, over a long period of just being around artists and asking the question, well, what would I learn if I followed that story in a much longer sort of larger scale or format than I am able to in a short magazine piece or something. And is it going to tell me something about the broader situation of contemporary art that we're all in? Are those little relatively minor idiosyncratic moments going to sort of open up in some way? And the result is that the book is very idiosyncratic. The choices are not meant to sort of map a territory in a systematic way. They're stories, you know. They're supposed to intimate certain things, and doing that, it's impossible not to be yourself. You know, it's to sort of be objective or anything like that. It's because of who I am and where I'm coming from. Like those are, it's sort of the choices that I make, or you know, they're obviously going to be that way. That sounded pretty terrible at the end.
That's okay. You can take another stab at it if you want. I can cut it out.
I think I don't.
That's fine. What I wanted to recognize is the fact that you do Paper Monument. You've said, and you've been writing quite a bit before you started the book. So these are two questions that align, but so you can take it however you want. But so one question is, how have you managed to be an artist who writes and not have that get in the way? Is that because your artist reputation was established essentially first? And then the sort of aligning question or overlapping question is, when you went and did this book and had these relationships, you know, with Dana Schutz, with Mary Walling Blackburn, and with Stephen Kaltenbach, who are the major characters of the book, did they know you were, you know, obviously Dana did because you guys went to school together, more or less, but the other two, to what extent did they recognize you as an artist, or did they even care?
That's a good question. Yeah, Stephen Kaltenbach didn't care. I mean, I think I sort of only, I feel like, I don't know, there was maybe a little bit more trust in certain aspects of the interviewing process because I was an artist and could, you know, ask questions which were pertinent to artist experience or sort of telepathically send out vibes that I was trying in a sympathetic and wholehearted way to understand where they were coming from, rather than because sometimes I think that you know, artists get a lot of accolades, but they also get misunderstood and mocked and sort of like accused of being, you know, bullshit artists by the mainstream media and sort of in journalism. And there's sometimes, and I'm not speaking about the people that I talked to specifically for the book, but it's sort of a little bit of a distrust of how they're going to be presented in narrative or in discourse. And I knew that going in and tried to sort of mitigate it. And so I approached the interviews like they were studio visits, basically. And one of the alternate titles of the book had something to do with studio visits.
Right,
you know? And then
right.
I'd overlapped with Dana. We're not great friends. But I think definitely like because of that, I felt like she, you know, at least was willing to give me the benefit of the doubt that I was, you know, going to take her seriously. Stephen Kaltenbach is much older and has a very sort of distanced relationship to the writing about him, or the people that are sort of studying him. He's very gracious as an interview subject and a person to talk to, and a very kind, wonderful man, but doesn't seem to be too interested in shaping the art historical discourse around himself, or, you know, like he doesn't really care. about who I was but he was totally happy to chat. And Mary Welling Blackburn, who I knew through writing, in fact, was quite sort of conscious of how artists tend to be written up concerned about being misrepresented and engaged my questions in a very, very intelligent, very self-conscious way, you know, and I was clearly sort of thinking about how what she said would become a book and what that would mean, was quite sort of like, I don't know, like understood the pitfalls of right. being represented in a book like this.
I feel all of your guests, you know, now that you've sort of framed them as, you know, as subjects, generally, those three anyway, because those are the main subjects. I don't feel like any of them were sticky, you know, the way that artists can be. I think they all have that in common.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, now that you're talking about the experience with Mary Welling Blackburn, I do feel like, and I think you maybe in so many words expressed this, she was a little prickly at times.
Yeah, and that's sort of, I think that's part of how she does things, and it's coming from that she believes in critique, and she believes in what she's doing, and she fights for it, and it was very, I knew that going in, and I think I chose them, or I gravitated towards them as subjects, because I thought they were going to be really honest with me, you know, and I'm really sick of reading the sort of boilerplate famous artist profile where you see their studio and then they go and get on a plane and go to another city with a journalist, and then the show is opening, and then they have some doubts in their studio, but then a famous person drops by and it's very cozy, and you don't really learn very much. And having talked a bit to Dana, you know, over the years, I knew that she was, you know, very willing to appear a little more vulnerable than the average
star,
sort of young art star. Yeah. And Stephen Kaltenbach has a philosophy of being very open, and that, you know, but I knew right there that he was kind of like honor bound, sort of like conceptually bound to sort of be a good interview subject. And
right.
So that was, I mean, you know, because I just wanted, I did want to deliver something with the book that wasn't the standard, isn't being an artist such a gas, thing that we get, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I don't, what you're referring to, I think, is like your, as you called it, boilerplate artist profile, which you can get in, you know, any magazine, art magazine other than Art Forum, you know, which does something that takes it, not to put them on a pedestal, but they take an entirely different approach, which is sort of unreadable in another way. But if you'll buy into that. But as far as books, though, and I'm kind of hesitant to bring this up, and maybe we can cut this out. But I honestly kind of felt like there's Sarah Thornton, you know, and her book or books, you know, and then you kind of came along. I mean, when I think of the landscape of books about the art world, you got, your guys' three books are the only ones that really come to mind. And what am I missing?
Yeah, it's a short little list. I mean, I think that, or at least in the past decade or so, Sarah Thornton's books are. I think they're phenomenal. I think they're dealing with a different stratum.
And
that's what I sort of realized through writing, is I was really, you know, I was interested in artists and what they're thinking, and then those situations, and then I wanted to leave sort of market reporting to people that were passionate about that, you know, and that's because I feel like that's the ideas about art that I think are propagated and you know, in like the big picture things, or like the kind of, or the broad brush treatment, is that, you know, there's a ton of money in it and it's very weird. You know, so it's like, how many books have you seen with like the Damien Hirst shark on it? You know, that's, there was a book called the $50 million stuffed shark, you know, which was, that's what art is, you know, for a general audience. And I just don't, I mean, I don't travel in those circles. I there was a sort of a, you know, I thought there was as much sort of a narrative drama in, you know, art school or sort of, being an artist assistant than you know, a Sotheby's day sale or whatever. Sarah Thornton would cover. Although she did a wonderful sort of, her account of Michael Asher's print class. So it was phenomenal.
Well, you know, I did a podcast with alumni from that class.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. So if you're curious.
You are.
Check. I did.
Oh well. Yeah. Wait, say that again?
I did a podcast called The Crit.
With alumni
from that actual class.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. So
that was awesome. How was it?
It was great. Yeah, it was great. We had three of the members of the class, including one who showed that day on in the room. We had another guy from Brooklyn on the phone, and then I did a separate conversation with a woman named Fiona down in New Zealand, who was another woman who showed two of the three who showed. So another one.
Oh, cool. What did they have to say about?
Well, you'll have to listen to it.
But, okay, I'll listen.
Yeah, it's probably not the best time for me to encapsulate. But basically, I mean, we could compare it to the, you know, the crits that you write about, you know, which you were involved in teaching, you know, at RISD. I mean, the ones that, it's interesting to compare them because yours are kind of hyper-focused and intense, and theirs are just kind of, you know, I mean, yours are so short, I think, is the takeaway compared to theirs, which ran, you know, an average of 4 to 5 hours per student.
Yeah, and it's a really different form.
Exactly.
Yeah, the sort of, I was kind of doing the kind of the speed dating version of that.
Right, exactly.
Where you're just kind of going through, you know, you have 35 minutes to get to the get to the point with each artist's work, and you're on to the next one.
Right, exactly. But you know, I think going back to what we were talking about as far as coverage of the art world, that I appreciate so much about your book is that, you know, everything does tend to revolve around kind of the tippy top of the art world, and there's just There's so much going down and lower down in the pyramid, you know, and I want to get to some of those things, actually. I really want to, because you are both an artist and, you know, somebody who's been thinking about, I presume, a lot of these fates, if you will, or for lack of a better word, you know, throughout the art world. I want to specifically look at a couple of your comments. And the first one comes in the chapter that you do on, you know, Milwaukee, the chapter about sort of alternate art centers. You wrote, the populations of working artists in the big market centers are stretched historically thin. They can hardly be said to exist in the center at all. And basically you talk about how they're freelance, but they work full time and so on and so forth. And then later, you know, I don't know if I should make this sort of a separate subject. Why don't I just stick with this one, because I can get to that one after we get to this. But I'm kind of interested in, you know, the whole spectrum of artist survival, basically. I think the one that you're sort of talking about in that paragraph is the as they call it in L.A., the freeway commuter, or it's something like the freeway adjunct, you know, like the freeway flyer, you know. It's like you're an adjunct at all these different schools. And, you know, so you can talk about that. You can talk about people who have assistant jobs or full-time jobs, you know, and they still make their work or whatever. I'm interested in, you know, maybe this one that you don't refer to, which is the artist that makes work that sort of barely survives, you know, on sort of being underemployed.
Yeah, the I mean, is that what a working artist is?
Well, I don't, that's a really good question. I mean, I think the my understanding of the way that people use the term working artist is that somebody, I mean, and this is, there's a lot of gray area here, but somebody who is sort of squeaking by with a living through their work. What I'm kind of trying to extend that definition to is, or the definition of an artist who makes work is that they take so little work and it is inevitably lower paid work that they have a lot of time to work, but they are just squeaking by. Whereas the people that I think you're referring to who are, you know, full-time freelance, I don't think financially it's an issue. I think it's just a time issue.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm much more, I mean, I think I tend to overdo it. Like, I sort of, I don't know, I just do too much and certainly sort of like.
So that's you,
write a
so that's
and,
you
and
you're talking about.
It. Yeah, but so I'm very conscious of sort of like the time deficit. I think those people are the real artists. Those are the people who are really doing it the way I think it needs to be done. And, where you do everything you can to open up as much time, to accrue as much time wealth as is possible, and you make other sacrifices to make that happen. And it does seem to be that's where the real progress gets made. I am also interested, though, in the sort of the way that art, the actual sort of art productions that we're seeing, have been so shaped by the reverse, by the experience of, you know, not having enough time to make your own art, one of a better word, but still functioning in that world, and sort of the incredible speed of certain kinds of production, or the appearance of speed, the aesthetic of something happening really fast and casually, the way it sort of fragments discourse, maybe again because this is my experience, you know, it's just it's a bunch of people who have they have X amount of time left over from teaching, working as a barista, working at a bookstore, bartending, whatever the case might be, and they can either see something or make something, and they choose to make something.
Right.
So my theory is that you know it's a community of people who are too busy to look at each other's work.
Right.
Because and that's the sort of the pressure, the real pressure and bummer of being sort of at the center or at the commercial center, which is, you know, there's so much more exposure, but you know, your time is just ground into nothing to sort of pay for that experience. And in looking at Milwaukee, I was like, well, what is it like in a place where the sort of real estate situation is slightly different, or where there is a sort of a, maybe it's more possible to subsist in the sort of classic artist sense and not have to work three jobs just to afford a studio, but work one job and actually have a little bit more time left over. And what I did find was that it seems to be that there are people that have practices that evolve over a much slower span of time, and people that sort of work intensively and long periods between exhibitions of the work, and then because there are fewer opportunities for exhibition, and yet you go and you see what they're doing, and it's incredible. You know, it's sort of like it's detached from the fashion cycles art that are happening in New York and LA and changing every 6 months, but they're changing every 10 years. And it's pretty thrilling. I'm stopping again.
That's fine. When you're talking about Milwaukee, I was thinking about the artist that came to mind, and for lack of exposing, some of those more artists more associated with that town, I thought of David Robbins, who you talked about and is known as this sort of art of comedy, and made the seminal piece called Talent, which were basically headshots of artists from the mid to late 80s. So I mentioned him because he's an artist who had sort of already sort of established himself to a certain extent and could then kind of go and retire or not retire. That's maybe a bad choice of words, but he could be an artist outside of the center and he could be in Milwaukee. But then I thought of a couple of artists who you mentioned a couple of times, but not very much, more through connection, Scott and Tyson Reeder. And I have not been following their careers closely, but I imagine that they are either in New York or LA right now. And that I'm curious to know if you understand that they sort of came out of the Milwaukee scene and that was maybe something to their advantage, that they were not just another New York artist. And so they were a Milwaukee artist who then became big in New York, if it was that kind of scenario.
Right. I think they sort of, they were definitely the kind of the elder statesmen, and they were in the weekend that I was there, they sort of came in to play this, or one of them did this funny concert where they were dressed as ghosts and somebody's like, are those the Readers? But I didn't know because I couldn't see their faces, but I think they were Chicago.
Okay.
People but from there moved there. I got the whole. It's a really fascinating sort of history, and you realize that sort of like very few people, like a handful of people, can make an enormous difference between a city like Milwaukee being dead as a doornail or really vibrant. And in the Milwaukee case, there were the Reeder brothers came. There was Chris Smith, who made American Movie. Is that his name?
Oh, right, Chris Smith.
Sure. Chris Smith, who studied at there's an experimental film school there, and he studied and then sold that movie, this documentary about someone making a horror film, for a huge sum, by sort of experimental film standards, and then made a production studio in the city, which employed people and generated things and just those kind of like a couple different things. And then David Robbins, sort of a Milwaukee native who had been in New York and worked for Warhol and then showed at Nature Morte and all these things in the 80s, like came back and was this sort of in-house media theorist, for the younger generations of artists. And those things sort of consolidated a scene, which is pretty vibrant and built around not like a local aesthetic, but a transaction between what was happening in the town and people that they were bringing in or something new from elsewhere. David Robbins is, enormously eloquent on the sort of the theory of the regional art center and how it might exist in 21st century art world, and it's based on sort of, he says, you sort of divert the flow of art thinking through your locality and pass it back into the stream, and so doing you become a node in the circuit, and it's a very cybernetic sounding.
Do you, as you're saying this, I'm thinking, he's probably onto something, and the way that gentrification and overpopulation is going, we're all going to have to adapt to that kind of situation. And I wonder to what extent you've considered where you are in Vermont or maybe another part of Vermont as trying to build one of those kinds of regional locations.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not such a scene builder as the thing. I mean, well, the other thing you need is somebody who really wants to make a scene. You know, be on the scene and sort of have the parties, host the parties, know where the parties are, that is not me at all. So I'm never going to sort of like germinate anything up here. But I do. I think the crucial thing, or that occurred to me when I was visiting with those artists there, is that I think the thing that would have to happen is that people who collect art and fund art understand art as a local product rather than an imported product.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if that makes any sense, but one of the I was talking to an artist named Nicholas Cueva who went to school in Chicago, and he said, you know, you have to, if you're a Chicago artist, the way to make it in Chicago is move to New York, have a show at a New York gallery, have a show at an LA gallery. And if you do both of those things, maybe somebody in Chicago will actually think you're an artist, you know, well, because you've been legitimated in the network.
Yeah.
And it does seem to be that sort of there's a, you know, the history of collecting art in America is, I mean, we go out and you used to go to Europe, bring back all the plunder and enrich your location. And it's, I think a lot of cities still, you know, are looking to that model when they understand art. You know, it's like, we don't need, you know, artist X who lives down the block. We have to get Pino Segal to come and do a project for
exactly.
Us.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I wonder if that can change. It's so much a part of how art is valued. But I worry that if it doesn't, then yeah, it's the idea of a self-sustaining sort of smaller art center is always going to be dependent on a fraction of those people making it big in sort of the market center.
Yeah.
You know. It's a perception of the local as valuable rather than second rate or potentially second rate or illegitimate.
And when the person or, you know, the wisdom of Chicago artist having a show in New York and then in LA and then, you know, you become a local hero or star or whatever, you know, to what extent is that tongue in cheek, you know, as far as how easy or uncomplicated that is to do?
Yeah, I know it's easier said than done, but I did get a sense of, you know, in my sort of very unofficial research, my totally unsystematic research, that it's really frustrating to feel that you're you know, you're working at the highest level in your town and the people that should be sort of supporting you are it's a mark against you rather than for you. And I think a lot of people in those situations are really fighting against that or sort of working to change the consciousness a bit, you know?
Yeah. It seems like at its best, because it's always, its worst is usually what's talked about, the Whitney Biennial would be the venue where, you know, regional artists would sort of have that stage and have on occasion.
Yeah, I think it's possible, but again, it's like there's this Gregory Shillette, do you know him?
No.
He's an art historian and artist. He wrote the book Dark Matter, which is about, I think the thesis of the book was roughly that you know, the art world, what we understand as art in the art world, like skims off this like incredibly thin layer of production over the vast sort of collective production of art that happens everywhere all the time and rewards it, you know, and the logic of the biennial is, it seems to be very similar, you know, quite sort of based on that, like in that, like, let's say there's a town where a lot is happening in art, you know, so there's a really active scene and there's like 100 people, you know, doing shows, doing pop-up shows, like running galleries, inviting people to town, like challenging each other, writing about the work, you know, to create something interesting. And one or two of them are going to get noticed and sort of extracted from that situation and put in a sort of national or international showcase, mm-hmm. you know, and everyone, and maybe that raises everybody's profile a little bit, but it does seem like it's also taking them out of that local scene, you know, and you know, they're not contributing anymore because they're off doing the biennial, they're off doing this or that, and then that disrupts or sort of dissipates the energy that had been produced there, and you know, and that's just sort of like it's that thing of like you can have artists that don't make artworks, but you can't have artworks without artists. You know, artists are the currency, really. You know, and the notable individuals are still what it's very much about, and that works against sort of the what somebody like Gregory Chouette was talking about, is this sort of like collective, collaborative energy that really makes those things possible in the first place. You know?
Yeah, yeah, right. Which reminds me a little bit of what you talk about. You quote the guy who talks about unionization, which maybe we can get to in a little bit. But I want you to speak to the sort of parallel quote to the one that we talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Where artists are stretched historically thin. And that comes in the Dropout, the end chapter with Stephen Kaltenbach. And it goes mm-hmm. In the context of sort of introducing the concept or the arc of how Kaltenbach dropped out in his own particular elephantitis way. You wrote, the mm-hmm. funny thing is most artists quit working. In fact, if you take into account all the post-art school artists who give it up after a few fruitless years kicking around Silver Lake or Bushwick, and the artists who get married and have kids and get a full-time job to pay for them, which goes back to your earlier quote, and the ones who get sick of being poor and go back to school for retraining, and the ones who simply get sick and or drop dead, then you realize that, statistically speaking, quitting making art is practically in a heat with starting to make it in the first place, which was great. And this is why, you know, you're speaking to the larger part of the pyramid. But I just want to clarify, you know, maybe you weren't intending to put too fine a point on it, but did mm-hmm. you mean at the end of that paragraph that basically as many people are in the process, it's maybe the early phases of trying to make it as artists, as there are people who are kind of getting to that point where they're going to fall off the map?
I definitely wanted to sort of, I mean, you talk about the attrition rate is so high, right? I mean, like, doesn't it seem, if just look at art school and
right.
10 years after art school, it's sort of undeniable. But the background for that quote was, you know, I was introduced to Stephen Kaltenbach through Bob Nickus, the curator who has written eloquently about dropping out and sort of the canon of dropout artists that among
sure.
whom he names, you know, Katie Noland, Lee Lozano, and Kaltenbach, and then of course going back to Duchamp, who, you know, mm-hmm. quit, quote mm-hmm. unquote, to play chess, and there is this sort of fascination with the people that walk away from it rather than the people that are they limp away from it, or they sort of gradually, you know, sort of just
yeah.
they disappear in quiet, mundane ways rather than dramatic, mysterious ways. And I just thought it was sort of funny that sort of those figures are so fascinating to us because they yeah. could have gone on. But the people that kind of slowly phase out of making art are not accorded that sort of intentionality or whatever to
exactly
to their things.
But, yeah, yeah.
You know,
I think to, you know, we're recreating that pyramid metaphor where the people at the top of the pyramid are former art heroes, you know.
Right.
Even Stephen Kaltenbach is a former.
Went, but...
Yeah, even Stephen Kaltenbach, your subject, is a former art hero of sorts, you know, who steps away in his own way. But what about this? I mean, that's 90, I don't know, I'd like to hear what your percentage would come out to be. But, you know, 90-some percent of people who come through who, I guess for the most part come through the art school system or university grad school system, come out and then limp away, you know? And are there any stories there, and, you know, or do we just not care because they limped away and that's not a story?
Yeah, I don't know. It'd be hard to, I couldn't sell it.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. I think that sums it up right there.
Yeah. It's fascinating, but I mean, I don't know. It's just the really fascinating thing for me that I sort of constantly marvel at is the art as a aesthetic activity that now most people do some kind of art, even if it's just Instagram. I mean, that's, you know, it's like, if we're talking about it, that's art. And so many of them have actually sort of like come to their visual behavior through some form of training, which we would recognize as art school. And it goes out into what they do in their life and the other fields that they pursue, so that hugeness and that sort of expansiveness. And if you throw in sort of, if you start thinking like a first generation conceptual artist, it gets even bigger, you know, and like in terms of what we might conceive of as art. You know, put against the sort of like ridiculously narrow, circumscribed, policed, country clubby version of the art world that we exist in, or, you know, we read about in the magazines, or we think about as official art and is sort of paid for monetarily valued in the culture. And that sort of tension is fascinating and crushing too, I think, for crushing to the imagination that there can be such an openness about art qua human activity and a closedness as art qua sort of officially validated culture, you know, as it exists in commercial galleries and institutions and international biennials.
Right.
The numbers are staggering. The difference in numbers is really, really incredible.
Yeah. You know, I think it's fascinating. I mean, I know we haven't dug into a lot of the book, but I mean, I think what's fascinating to me regarding you as an artist who, as you put it earlier, you know, you're not part of that scene, as in, you know, the jet set, you know, auction house, etc., country club even maybe scene. But I do want to draw your and listeners' attention to that you have a New York gallery, and as I was looking at your work and your some of your shows, you are in this show called Item, correct, at the Tony Mitchell Innes and Nash Gallery, and with some gigantic names, no less, in that show, including Giorgio Morandi.
It was a highlight of my career so far. I was next to like this Morandi statue.
Yeah,
you know, I could just quit right then.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, you kind of saw my end game, but. Actually, I'm curious, you know, in the context of what you said earlier, and my curiosity about the fact that you are an artist who's also a writer and thinking about, you know, all of these filters and whatnot and categorizations of the art world that go on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if it would be too much to ask. I'm kind of thinking of that moment towards the latter part of the chapter, the end. I think I should, this is a good time for me to sell your book a little bit and quote it. let me just, yeah. So it's towards the latter part of the your chapter called The End with Stephen Kaltenbach, the subject. And you talk about his, just to let listeners know, his project of sort of dropping out isn't just to drop out. He becomes kind of like a working class or sort of, you know, a regional or kind of a combination of sort of figurative public sculpture artist and department store painter and, you know, mm-hmm. you know, airbrush artist and so on. And that's all part of his long-term project, which he calls the Elephant Project. Is that the term?
Yeah, that's right.
And so you point out that when you sort of get to this critical point in your interview with him, you know, which I assume took place over many days, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You say, though he was forthcoming about most everything else, Kaltenbach was unwilling to spend a lot of time on elephantology during our interview. And he says, I thought about it some, he said. I have some understanding of how things occurred to me and why I did them. But I don't really have time to go into it to any extent, which is just brilliant. You know, that's right, where yeah. I draw the line, he says. So that being said, as a setup, what I want to ask you about is, and I feel like this is maybe a little gauche, but I'm going to go for it anyway. How did your getting into this item show kind of come about? I mean, what were the various channels?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. It was really, it was very, well, I don't know what the word you used earlier to describe the show. It was,
Tony.
It was very pedestrian. Tony, it was very un-Tony. It was an artist named Mamie Tinkler, a great painter that I whose work I like a lot, worked at Michelinus and Nash and was curating that show unofficially. And
right.
She and I had been known her for a long time. We looked at each other's work for a long time, and she had an idea that a painting that I was doing would fit into the idea of that show. So it was, yet another reason to be in New York or be sort of like around the scene is that those things, can happen sort of semi naturally if you're just sort of like around a lot of people. But having said that, it was totally awesome to be in a show like that. That sounds totally lame, but
you can rewrite it. You can rewrite it. We can cut that out.
Well, maybe it sounds great. It was. I think it's just. I spent. I was in New York for about a decade or a little over, including school, and when we relocated up here for my wife's job, I still felt a bit like. If I go away, am I just going to become totally invisible? Is that okay? Is that actually what I should do? Is that the more virtuous path as an artist? People are very anti-reclusive right now, which is, I think, one of the reasons why, Bob Nickus is sort of so invested in the idea of the dropout, and that why that's so fascinating is that the dropout is, it's just not done right now. You're supposed to be hyper networked at every. That's how you succeed. That's clearly how you succeed. You're plugged into it. So withdrawal is not really an option right now. So because of that, I was like, maybe it's worth a try. But
Let me help you out a little bit. One artist put it to me when we were talking about somebody who had was moving to Oregon to teach. His response, mm-hmm. "Bye." It's basically that's basically the sentiment. It's like, okay, you're gonna leave. See ya. We're gonna forget about you now.
I know. Yeah. You have to. I think when I first arrived in New York, I looked at some of the artists that I was meeting and some of the people that were teaching me, and realized that you have to have it in you to become a creature of pure dinner party to make it, to sort of like build your life in the art world and just sort of be, have. 50 years on, you're still wanting to be on the scene and going to the openings and everything. And that's sort of, where it happens. And then David Robbins, of Milwaukee had some very funny things to say about that. He said, when in 1979, if I left New York, I wouldn't have been able to have the New York information. And now, thanks to the internet, I have about 70% in Milwaukee, and the other 30% is just who sat next to who at dinner.
Yeah,
and that who sat next to who is pretty, it's an important 30% of the information to have in something like art.
It sounds like my sense is that you're a little bit on the introverted side, and so while you love engaging, you know, in these kinds of conversations, I imagine that, you know, being at those dinner parties and openings and what have you, you know, hyper frequently must have been pretty draining, or must be, I should say, because I'm sure you still do it to some extent.
Yeah, well, when I was living in New York, I spent most of my time feeling bad because I didn't want to go out to do this or that thing. You know, mainly because I wanted to be in the studio, and as I'm sure most artists can relate to. You know, it's like I'll go out to see friends, but and gladly, you know, go out and support. But the other sort of pro forma sort of appearances in the social scene were, I find it very painful. When I left New York, you know, I would think longingly about those same invitations that I would have, you know, I knew I wouldn't have gone, you know, because I didn't feel like I had the time, and I would have blown it off to get some work done. But sitting up in Vermont, I was like, oh, that's probably the best panel discussion ever. You know, like, I wish I was there. I bet they're having a great time. And it became, you know, sort of funnily, you know, sort of like, I felt very wistful about it. But yeah, no, it's a real... it's grueling, and some people do it really well. Like somebody said to me recently, like, you either have to socialize totally or not at all. Those are your two options, you know, and, you know.
But it seems like you do, as much as that grass is always greener phenomenon has, you know, has existed, you do still have that pied-à-terre studio, right, in the city. So, and you're going back, you know, somewhat regularly. So, you're not really gone. You've clearly made that. You've covered that that base.
Yeah, so far. I mean, it could just be like a very, very slow disappearance that we're witnessing. But I'm hoping not to.
So, getting back to Item, the Mitchell Innocent Nash show, and thinking about the half-ass box set theory that you taught with that Bob Nickus introduced to you. Bob Nickus, by the way, sounds like he was the godfather of your or the mentor for this book in a lot of ways. So now that you've been in this show Item, you could potentially be, if nothing else, you know, a box set artist, right?
Right, like a footnote to
is it that reductive?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know if it's a sort of an error of perception or historically accurate that there are just so many more people that are doing this now than 2 decades ago or 2 generations ago.
Right.
I'm sure there's a tremendous sort of erasure of the historical record that happens at every given time. Yeah, lots of artists in Florence in the 15th century that were making work. We know very few of them now, but the attrition rate seems very staggering. Are there sort of like the capacity of the historical record to reflect the really huge amount of people that are doing, I think, really great work right now?
Yeah,
it gives one pause, you know. It's just like, what are the forms of narrative? What are the forms of art historical narrative that we need to develop to accommodate the fact that the art world is on a different scale, you know, or contemporary art production is on a much higher scale. You know, is it going to be like, you know, like Robert Pincus Witten's post-minimalism book, where you look back on the 70s and there were 12 people, you know, that were making meaningful work. That's depressing, you know, and sort of not just that speaking as an artist, but speaking as somebody who likes art or sort of like wants to see it recorded in a way, you know. It's just, there's just so much. And again, and I would argue that so much of it is really valuable and worth looking at, and it just far exceeds the capacity of institutions or history to record. You know, does that ever freak you out?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I was thinking as you were, I think what the takeaway here is, yes, the attrition rate is gigantic. And you go back, the way I was thinking of it, you know, you being in that show, and so you could then, if nothing else happened, you could be a candidate for a box set, you know.
Historical retrieval.
Right, 30 to 40 years down the road. But as you point out, this retrieval, there's what I like to use the word exhume, you know, like these artists are exhumed to be institutionalized. That I feel like I don't know if you have a sort of an East Coast timeline, but I feel like that really started going in earnest with that series of shows called Pacific Standard Time out here, which I don't know how well you are aware of that out there, but you know, like Richard Jackson had this show at a hot gallery, and you know, he hadn't had a gallery show in decades, it seemed like, you know. And it's been going on, you know, ever since. You know, there are going to be shows opening up this weekend, you know, at least a couple with vintage artists, you know. And so
but now
30 or 40 years down the road, there's just not going to be any room, because it's just going to be a, you know, a thick pyramid towards the top of, you know, of these already canonized artists.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, it reminds me of, like, you know, I got into art because I was a comic book kid growing up in the 80s, and then collected comic books and realized at a certain point that the print runs were so vast that none of it was ever going to be, you know, valuable. You know, it's just the kind of, and I was, I felt really sad at a certain, you know, when I was 15 or something, when I realized that the whatever, you know, double bagged mint edition DC comic I thought was going to, you know, put my kids through college was not going to appreciate in value because the production was too high. And the same might be said for art, you know, artists, but it's just sort of, there are too many of us.
I think I had a long list of pages and moments from your book that I was going to get to, but since we're only going to get to a handful of them, I would say the one that I want to get to most is the artist assistants. You know, particularly Audrey Robinson, who did paintings for Vanessa Beecroft, and even more particularly this guy named Sean Greathead, great name, Sean Greathead, who works. Do you know if he's still doing in that department now to this day?
He is. Yeah.
Okay. So he is in the sculpture painting department. Where else in the world could one be working in a department called sculpture painting? So to me, I mean, we could talk about the details of, you know, what he does and whatnot, which is certainly interesting in itself. But to me, and this goes throughout the chapter, but particularly with this guy, Sean, and this woman, Audrey, I'm wondering what your take is on having conversations both with them and other people who aren't in the book at all. Mm-hmm. To what extent, you know, an artist in doing a job like that, whether it's part-time among other jobs, 10 hours a week, or it's like Sean full-time with benefits, you know, does your autonomy or your, not your autonomy, I'm not sure the right word is, but your identity gets co-opted, or it gets basically, you know, maybe emasculated. I don't know what the right word is. It's out there, but I'm not sure those two fit. But you know what I'm saying. You know, I mean, from my perspective, it's, you know, I went to grad school with a woman who worked for Matthew Barney, and you know, my reaction was, you know, that's awesome, and she was really, really proud of it, and you know, and had a tremendous amount of respect for him. But it's hard for me to sort of make peace with, you know, giving yourself over to it's like when you're an artist and you do something else, like I do this podcast, you do, you know, the book and the writing, you know, when your identity becomes that other thing.
Yeah. It's a tough thing. I mean, as with other things in the book, like I started thinking about like artist assistants as narrative protagonists, partly because, you know, that seemed unlikely to be covered by other writers. It's just sort of such an unglamorous
right.
Part of the art world. You know, there's so much kind of, you know, I've worked for people and, you know, and you, it can be great and satisfying. It can be a real pain in the ass, emotionally, psychologically fraught, I would say, for right. a lot of people, for a lot of artists,
right.
you know, to sort of do something that you want to be doing, for yourself, for someone else. And it can also be like the best sort of educational experience that you can have in art, in terms of just sort of understanding sensibilities and business practices, and then the sort of the language and the speech and the manner of someone else. But you kind of have to be willing to check your ego a little bit to work for someone else. I think in bigger studios, like Sean works at the Kuhn Studio, it's so routinized in a way that I think he really compartmentalizes and just treats it as,
right.
as a good gig where you do not uninteresting work with people that are also interesting and creative. And then he goes home and he makes music and does his art, which is totally different than Kuhn's, and doesn't have any sort of ego transference, Oedipal, whatever,
right.
You know, I think, I think in sort of more intimate or long-term assistant situations, like, yeah, I mean, it seems like there could be risks of just, you know, you work for someone for so long that you just sort of subsume your personality to them. And that's the figure of, if Audrey Robinson, who worked for Beecroft, was the sort of figure of the young artist who works for an older artist in a very intimate setting, and it becomes very psychological, and Sean, working in the Kuhn Studio, is the opposite of that. He's the sort of it's the artist studio as you know, sort of like boring creative sector, you know, like
yeah.
cottage industry. Then the sort of the figure that I didn't want to talk about was the sort of the person who works for someone for 20 years and their work slowly becomes more and more similar to their bosses, and they are very sad. You know, that just seems like too depressing to talk about. It's sort of mean spirited, but
right.
But I mean, like, sort of the all the different ways that assistantships sort of like create lineages. You know, and again, you can sort of like think about like so many artists who they worked for. It was a very, very successful sort of psychological, emotional professionalization experience, where they sort of came out of a work relationship and deconnected from their boss and established their own identity and were helped along, you know, by sort of that transmission of things. I mean, more often than not, it's like a great experience. But just sort of the comedy of working in an artist studio was also something that I was very attuned to. It's just such a strange thing to be doing, you know?
Yeah. You wrote about in the book how you worked for this artist in Salinas. Was it one summer?
Yeah, it was like a summer gig up in San Francisco, actually.
San Francisco, right. But I wanted to know, you mentioned kind of casually in passing that you had worked for people. Have you worked for people in New York?
I worked as a printmaker in this wonderful print publishing studio called Two Palms Press. And so it was my sort of like assistantship by proxy, where artists would come and make monoprints or etchings or whatnot. And so, and it was a very small group of, you know, really cool people that would come in and do work. And so it wasn't this like psychologically full sort of like being in somebody's studio on a day-to-day basis, but I would just get a taste of like what it would be like to wash Terry Winter's brushes for full time.
Right.
And it's great. You pick up so much, you know, and it's just kind of, I mean, basically, I think sort of studio practices, most of it is really fairly mindless, you know, and rote and sort of logistical, but you have great conversations, you know, especially when you're doing it with other people. It's all about what you're talking about when you're washing the brushes.
Right.
You know, what you overhear when, you know, so-and-so comes to have lunch.
Right.
And things like that. You know, those are the really sort of valuable apprenticeship aspects of working for people.
Do you recall having any experiences that have helped you or guided you through your own maybe conceptual crises, you know, in thinking through your work, or is it not? Yes,
through sort of other. I don't know, I remember. Well, the guy that the person that I worked with is named Michael Gray, a great sculptor, and I was young. It was when I was in college. I was just so desperate for any kind of understanding about art. And then one of the things that he said was, "You have to have a really deep bag of tricks to be an artist," you know, meaning that sort of anybody can kind of have one or two ideas and put them out there, and that, you know, you go for, you know, you can go for 5 years on that, but the really great artists have a, you know, very deep bag of tricks, and they can sort of reach in and pull something else out after after a while and keep doing that. And for some reason, it's such an offhand remark, you know, just something that you say to a, you know, a college kid when you're eating a burrito or something in the studio, but it stayed with me. It's just like, really, like, yeah, that's the ticket. And again, it's sort of, I mean, I think like all of it is just chance things, you know, and I'd much rather sort of, I'd much rather work in an art situation and deal with sort of ego frustrations and, sense of anxiety than work a straight job, you know.
Mm. Have you had any assistance?
Never. I've never been able to do that. My work is it doesn't lend itself very well.
Sure.
To that, but I'm more open to it now. But I just sort of I mutter to myself when I paint, and it would seem very weird to have somebody.
What do you mutter to yourself?
Swear words, like invective, and you know, sort of insults to myself and painting and other artists, probably.
I really am into details, so bear with me. But I mean,
I know. Yeah,
Are we talking about, you know, you know, fuck, this is not turning out the way I had envisioned, or fuck, I'm such a shitty painter, or what kind of, you know?
Yeah, but more, even more than that, more graphic. And,
wow. Is that,
I think a lot of people have probably like sort of studio Tourette's in a way, and just, you know, you're there by yourself. It's just you. You know, whatever it takes to make it happen. I think the sort of, you know, the Paul McCarthy video where he's playing de Kooning, I think it's called The Painter.
Okay.
And he's wearing a sort of Pinocchio-esque mask and giant sort of oversized hands and squirting mustard and ketchup on the painting. And he's saying, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it anymore over and over again. Sort of that.
Uh-huh. Right. Right. That's awesome. I have to ask you, even if you won't want to say, because you mentioned, I'm curious, a lot of your chapter on Kaltenbach, you're in L.A., and you mentioned your friends,
Yeah.
your friends James and Susan. Are those art world professionals that people might be aware of?
Yeah, I'd rather not.
That's okay. So you probably don't want to.
I mean, is that okay?
Yeah. That's, yeah, you obviously don't want to say then who the narcissistic photographer.
Oh, the nervous breakdown. Yeah, no, I'm not. Only because I should be totally more brave and say that. But one of the
Can you tell me off record if I kind of promise to cut it out?
Yeah, I'll email it to you.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
No, I just I was really in, especially with the studio assistant bit, really struck by how intimate that work situation is.
Mm.
And how it was, you know, it's like I heard a million, and how sort of responsible I had to be to other people's confidences and to those relationships, which are really, you know, intense, really intense relationships. If they're interesting, you know, if they're sort of narratively interesting, the relationships are pretty fraught. And, so I heard so many things off the record, which were amazing stories of, you know, like abuse and degradation and hedonism and ridiculousness and fraudulence. And it was hard to not include all that, you know, or to turn it into something which was just pure comedy or pure, you know, dirt or gossip. So I became a lot more careful, I think, over the course of writing the book with those sorts of issues, I guess.
Isn't a significant amount of artist communal time, you know, dirt talk?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It really is, isn't it?
I know it's so much of everything. It's like kind of like I went to sort of, you know, trying to write about this or that, I was like, you know, to see, you remember how something is talked about at a certain point in time, you know, and it's just like the conversation goes in a certain way. But you can never think of like a specific, you know, piece of writing you had where this or that was said. It was just kind of this conversational ether that we exist in and sort of get information from it. And a lot of that sort of conversational flow is dedicated to gossip and shit talking and,
yeah,
this or that, and again, I can't name names, but a friend who say worked for an older artist who would just his studio banter was just thinking of really cutting remarks to sort of like say about other artists while he was making his paintings, so then he would, you know, and then he would go out and spread them around town, you know, after he was done in the studio. It's like very incisive little, you know, sort of like surgical strikes on other people's reputation.
Right. You know, I was thinking as you were describing that, I wonder to what degree an artist's success, you know, or even canonization is inverse to their dirt talking. But then I thought, especially as you were talking about that latter anecdote, that really, that's just integral to, you know, to artists in the, you know, in the competitive art world, because that's part of the competition, right?
Yeah, I think so. I wonder if that too is sort of their different styles. I mean, I read the Jack Goldstein and the CalArts Mafia.
Right, right.
Did you ever see that?
I read it. Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's a great book. Just you get a sense. I got a sense of how aggressive those guys, mainly guys, were,
right,
you know, just like sort of, maybe it was just Jack Goldstein, but you get a sense of that, the sort of the, and it sort of tallied with other encounters that I'd had with people from that sort of era or something, where it was just, it was really macho and really, you really shit talked in a way that I think isn't, I think people are more circumspect right now, you know, in how they do it. It's less sort of frontal assault and more, you know, like politeness and insinuation and maneuvering. But it's a weird sort of bond. I think it's a form of bonding.
Exactly.
To,
yeah.
For people.
In the best of cases, in the worst, you know, you're making the other person pretty nervous.
Yeah.
I think a great place to end, this might be a far-reaching segue, but an ongoing sort of topic on the podcast is the explosion of abstraction. And, you know, particularly with the phrase, the explosion of abstraction in the marketplace. And as somebody yourself, I looked at your work. You've done representational paintings and watercolors and paintings that are abstract. So, you know, having examined examining the art industry and world as you have and having made these paintings, I think you're primed to speak particularly well to that phenomenon.
Uh-huh. The explosion of abstraction.
Yep.
Yeah. Anything in particular?
Yeah. Well, I think I was going to say. I mean, you could first answer by saying if you think it's on the decline or what have you. I mean, certainly. I wouldn't want to make it just about the process-based abstractionists as they're so called. But you know, there's also a mannerist abstraction. I don't follow all the resources and the critical pieces very well at all, but certainly just from kind of doing a scan, you keep getting that.
Yeah, I think that here's my line on that, which is I think we artists, we as painters, need to deal with the fact that painting is the way painting ideas change seems to be much more cyclical and fashion-oriented and linear and art-historical. And to think that that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does create certain sort of inconveniences for artists. Like, for example, I don't know, when I was in graduate school, one of the reasons that I started making my, I don't think they're even abstract, kind of abstract, abstract-ish painting, was that you would get thrown out for doing that. It was just dead and there was just no space, for sort of that thought, and so it seemed very funny to include that in my practice in some way, or almost as a, not as a joke, because I don't think of them as jokes, but a note on how art discourse was being formulated. And then, and 10, 15 years later, it's all you see and you're nauseated by it. But for someone who really wants to have like a career doing one thing, that's very inconvenient to sort of go in and out of fashion five or six times over the lifespan of an artist. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's like the sort of like the supply and demand forces sort of governing what looks good in painting are so like not what painting's about. I think you just have to kind of like write them out. I think it's that's a terrible response.
Well, I can help you out here.
Totally
actually.
Limp. Yeah.
I can help you out actually. Going back to the beginning of our conversation, almost where I was asking about Leonard Lopez experience, I actually quoted him recently. It's a interview a conversation that has really stuck with me. A quote in particular, he had Massimo Gioni on when he had the new museum had the show up art from the Arabic world, and Gioni in response to a question sort of about this political art, whether that was maybe a little dogmatic or what have you, Gioni said, there's something about work that's not just visual entertainment. And I wonder, and that I think that's a really interesting line. And I wonder, I know you have a lot of articulation around, the complexity of painting and whatnot, but how would you boil that down from your perspective?
Yeah, about video entertainment. I think that I was talking with my friend George Rush recently that there's a number of arguments you could make for painting right now in terms of positioning it differently than it is, or sort of easing some of the intellectual tensions that we feel as painters, and then justifying it as a historically relevant experience. One of it is visual entertainment is, you know, sort of the last resort for you don't really want to go there, but I think painting is, well, first, abstract painting is so familiar now, right? It's so, it's a visual language that a lot of people understand and sort of can get with and share. It's not populist by any stretch of the imagination, but it's much more popular. It's much more like sort of certain forms of a novel or certain semi-experimental music than it is like historical avant-garde forms right now. You know, and maybe the thing about painting is that it's detached itself from one contemporary art trajectory, sort of that started in the 60s and sort of like led through institutional critique and social practice and sort of like these, I don't know, sort of like post-object forms. And it's much more like reading a book now, you know, and that's not bad, you know, that doesn't mean it's not good art or it's not worth doing. It's just not innovating in the same way that other art forms are now. Does that make any
yeah,
sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I would just add the follow-up with the question, to what degree does its complacency, or potential complacency, and certainly inevitable acquiescence to collectors come into play?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I think that there's a lot of artists that spend so much energy, like feeling bad about people buying their work or potentially buying their work, that it becomes a sort of a paranoid or obsessive inversion of cynical market based practices, where it's like all you manage to do as an artist sometimes is sort of prove that you're not working for the market, and that becomes the content.
Right.
And that seems sad. That's not that, you know, that's, I think it tends to be a certain kind of painting that does that. You know, I'd rather have other content, which is sort of, you know, like of human interest or of historical interest or philosophical interest, that rather than sort of like positioning myself in some, you know, weird moralistic ethical wrangling over like whether or not my art is collectible and that's somehow bad. Very advanced art is highly collectible. You know, I don't. It seems like actually sort of a non-starter, and I think it's a side issue. I mean, I just sort of I love looking at paintings. I will never buy them. Like, I don't. It sort of doesn't. You know, so the idea that sort of like painting has to sort of self-consciously wrestle with its purchasability or its commodifiability more so than other forms of art do it seems really silly to me. You know, it seems like a real waste of time, you know?
So in other words, you are somebody who relishes and appreciates the dialogue around painting, and yet at the same time don't have any trace of fetishization of the object. I mean, if you really mean that you don't want to own paintings, I mean, I imagine you have some trades.
Oh, I would never. I just would never. I'm not in any sort of position.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
You know, sort of. So it doesn't. You know, it's like that. Like, I'm glad that people. And I'm also sort of like, I'm really happy when someone buys one of my paintings. Like I will say that on the record, and I'm totally psyched. I feel great about it when that happens. And I think most artists probably do, you know, and I think it's just, the other way to say it is, like, the last thing I want to think about when I'm looking at someone's painting is that artist's attitude towards the form of painting or the sort of commodification of painting.
Right.
That's just like, that's a snooze, you know. Like, don't tell me that. I don't, sort of like, tell me about your day.
What's an example of work that's so self-conscious about its commodification? I mean, certainly,
I don't know. I think it's more just like the discourse of,
right,
the, you know, sort of a lot of the sort of the before, I think, the sort of the real boom before the real abstraction boom, right? I think a lot of the sort of the precursors to that were work which tried to sort of reflect on painting as a, you know, sort of as a value form, and some of that work is really great. It just sort of, and maybe I'm responding to the way people talk about things, or sort of the sort of being in an academic situation and they're hearing people talk about it. You know, I'm not really a painter, or I don't want to be one of those painters that, you know, it's just about visual entertainment, and this painting is about capitalism, and, you know, maybe it is.
Well, I mean, you have, I imagine, there's some kind of polemical divide between painters, you know, object makers, even if you want to extend it beyond painters, and you know, sociopolitical art makers in the Northeast, you know, art making part of the art industry that you're part of. You know, certainly here I can boil it down to, you know, kind of the UCLA school, you know, that came out of Paul McCarthy and Chris Burden and others.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that one of those artists whom I had on the show a few years ago in the early days of this podcast, who speaks for a lot of other artists, you know, when they dismiss, you know, painting's relevance.
It becomes very tribal in a way, or sort of the discussions. I wonder if it's like because it's something that most art students go through at some point, usually early on in their art education, that it's easier to think that you've kind of passed through it. You know, like, or you've done that and understood that, and then that. Whereas I never passed through sort of other forms of conceptual art because I decided I like painting, and so I don't have that sense of like having rejected something. So I'm very interested in it.
When you were in Columbia, because you alluded to this, but you didn't talk about yourself in it, you must have been then really up against it with making that work Columbia at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting time to be in school because, you know, I always joke that the first question that you get in any studio visit is, why are you still painting?
Right.
You know? So already you're sort of like, you're historically justifying something in a very broad, broad way, or historical way, or philosophical way. And then maybe in the last 5 minutes of a crit, you could get into sort of like the particular paintings that you're making rather than just the fact that you're choosing to engage with it. And that was it's very valuable. I think it's like, it's interesting because I don't think that sort of thing happened so much after I got out of school, you know, and certainly, you know, with that particular school became very painting friendly, you know,
right.
Totally pro painting after that. But just you get a sense that sort of younger artists that are sort of engaging with painting or abstract painting in particular didn't go through that sort of late 90s ringer, you know, like mindfuck about the historical obsolescence of their form or its sort of like total capitulation to the market forces. They're just doing it, you know, they're happy to do it. It's like, I always say it's like, I don't like rock songs with long guitar solos. Some people do, you know, I don't, it's like, I'm never gonna, it's like some people like painting, some people don't. It doesn't bother me as nearly as much as it used to when someone writes it off as irrelevant. It's fascinating to me that we're at a time where there's, you know, whatever, like there's still life painting from observation, and there's collaboratively authored activist projects indebted to strands of conceptual art, and those are both the same thing officially. You know, they're both in the same like bin in the culture industry warehouse, right, where we're shopping. You know,
it's
both
really
contemporary art,
right? It's really appropriate that you use that music, that guitar solo analogy or metaphor, because I sometimes think about the analogy between art making and music, because with music, it's perfectly acceptable to do covers, you know, and to work in these well-established forms. Whereas with art, it's often, you know, circumspect. So, it sounds like maybe you are aligning to some extent with that, you know, music making structure.
It might be. I mean, maybe it's just where I see painting positioned in terms of larger. It seems like it's certainly, you know, and I think, I don't know if it was Isabel Grah, somebody made the point recently, but you know, increasingly the art industry looks a lot more like pop music, in that there's kind of like, you know, next year there will be 50 new bands, 50 new artists, and, you know, but really there's a smaller percentage of them that are going to have any sort of like career longevity. You know, that's such a sort of music industry system for dealing with novelty and supporting it. So, but I mean, more, it's just the sort of the capacity of, it's interesting, like the capacity of the form to, you know, articulate the kind of content that I want, you know, and sort of like popular music is inherently corrupt, you know, and sort of, and operating in the market, a product of the market, and developed in the market. And that doesn't mean, there aren't sort of meaningful, radical utterances, you know, sort of formed in popular music.
And, right.
We're sort of working, I think, with art with some very outmoded categories of, in terms of like how we imagine that this stuff is functioning, you know, sort of economically and conceptually and politically.
But if you're going to use pop as a, you know, in that conversation,
right,
maybe what some of the Sacramento-based work of Stephen Kaltenbach would maybe fit more into that category, whereas, you know, what's done in the sort of art centers is maybe not analogous to pop.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's totally possible. It's not immune to market forces in any by any stretch of the imagination, or it's just a much smaller market,
right,
much more elite,
right,
market. I don't know. I think that one of the things that I loved about Kaltenbach is the appeal to popular art forms was, on the one hand, very strategic and sort of tongue-in-cheek, but on another level, very sincere, you know, very felt and kind of, and for sort of, and also sort of anticipated the way contemporary art would develop after conceptual art. You know, it's like he was playing out this sort of return to painting, return to representation, sort of like intermediate practices in this totally bonkers way in Sacramento when he's making films, you know, and sort of answering the question of, you know, what do you do with art after you've reached this like ultimate purity of conceptualism? You go off in a totally weirdo direction, which is some sort of outside the critical language that's been established.
Yeah. Well, if I ever do make it up to Sacramento, I'm dying to see Portrait of My Father at this point.
It's amazing. It's worth a trip. It's absolutely worth it.
Well, Roger, I'm sure like me at this point, you're probably exhausted, but
I really
appreciate you you taking the extra time. This is going to be probably the longest podcast I've had, but I think it's worth it. But let's just sign off by saying thank you so much for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. And there you go. We made it. Longest episode of the podcast ever. Forgot to do the sign-off. I was so exhausted, and we're out. Thank you very much again to Roger White for his generosity with his time, his patience, his willingness to indulge in all of those particular and specific angles about the art industry and being an artist. I hope you found that rewarding and intriguing in many ways. I look forward to hearing what you think about it. Feel free to weigh in via email or social media. What else? I wanted to let you know that, as I've mentioned occasionally in the past, I would very much appreciate your help on the show, and that can be in official capacity as an intern through school, or I am also very much looking for a producer in the mold of Brendan McDonald, a podcast reference that if you get that, you will know exactly what I'm talking about. So do get in touch if you are interested in learning more about producer and or intern roles via theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com or through the website, theconversationpod.com, and I will tell you more. And do again, let us know what you thought of this episode. We appreciate your feedback very much. I will leave it at that. And thank you very much again for being here. I will talk to you soon.